from Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Yemenis say foreign intervention in Yemen punishes civilians. Reasons behind the rising tide of violent Islamic extremist groups. What migrants face after the treacherous crossing of the Mediterranean.
You have in Europe, in a number of countries, populist, right-wing, anti-immigrant political parties that really prey on people's fears.
And the U.S. Secretary of Defense visits South Korea. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yaki. Residents say the war in Yemen is misunderstood and mismanaged, with foreign intervention responsible for what has become a humanitarian disaster. And while some hold out hope Saudi airstrikes will help the government to return to power, many say the only foreign help they want is help returning the warring parties to the negotiating table. VOA's Heather Murdoch has details from Cairo.
This amateur video is believed to show an injured man dragging himself across a street in Aden as Houthi fighters attack the city. The battles are usually described as pitting the Houthis, backed by Iran and former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, against the government, backed by Saudi Arabia and its coalition. But an activist and journalist who recently left Aden, Samer Nasser, says after Yemeni President Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi, recognized internationally, fled the city, much of the regular army stopped fighting in Aden, leaving residents to fight the Houthis.
You have people naturally defending their homes, their families. So you have a lot of bloodshed on the way, unfortunately.
She says Saudi airstrikes technically support the anti-Houthi fighters, whoever they are. But Yemeni people complain they kill indiscriminately. And Saudi blockades are keeping food imports, supplies, and humanitarian aid out, while keeping all the people in. Even the Houthi militia in the southern port city of Aden is not really made up of people who self-identify as Houthis from their homeland in Yemen's far north, but of soldiers loyal to ousted President Saleh. But among the northerners that have traveled to Aden to fight, Nasser says, are children.
They are carrying AK-47s. They're literally like dragging them. That's how small they are, these children.
The World Health Organization reports that at least 560 people have been killed and 1,768 wounded, many of them civilians, since the rebels and their allies launched an intensified battle on March 19th. The dead include at least 74 children killed since the start of the airstrikes, UNICEF said, and at least 44 children have been wounded. The United States has promised to increase military aid to Saudi Arabia as aid workers struggle to import medical supplies into Yemen, a dynamic that hits Yemenis hard. In the capital, Sana'a, where the Houthis are basically in charge, some residents say they did not want the Houthis to take over, but also say airstrikes are further punishing the people, not helping them. At his grocery store on a busy thoroughfare in Sana'a, Ahmed Al-Awliki says airstrikes can only grow Houthi influence in Yemen, as people are increasingly angry at Saudi Arabia. Like many Yemenis, he believes negotiations are the answer, despite several rounds of failed peace talks. At a nearby drugstore tucked behind Sana'a's main hospital, pharmacist Ali Abdullah Jahlan agrees. He says if foreign powers are not working towards peace talks, they should get out altogether. Others in town are more hopeful about the current situation, despite the growing danger and fear. Ibrahim, a youth activist, says airstrikes may force militants to return to their dens in the north. But while he is staunchly anti-Houthi, he does not want the Houthis all killed, just out of the capital. Houthis were once known as a movement in Yemen rather than as militants, and their beliefs are rooted in an offshoot of Shia Islam, a large minority in Yemen. While battle lines are drawn in this war, as in other Middle East conflicts, between Sunni and Shia Muslims, analysts say the fighting has nothing to do with religion. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Despite news reports that the momentum of the self-styled Islamic State has stalled, the allure of Islamic militant groups in general remains strong across the Middle East. Part of the explanation for the staying power of such groups is that while they often commit horrific acts, many young people in the region feel betrayed by the failed promise of the so-called Arab Spring. With their dreams in tatters, some see violence as a last resort, and they are easily swayed by the appeal of ISIS-affiliated groups in places like Libya, Yemen, and Egypt. Political science professor Nathan Brown of Georgetown University spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the reasons behind the rising tide of violent extremist groups.
Professor Nathan Brown, why do you think moderate Islamists in the Middle East were sidelined while militants are having the upper hand now?
I think that those groups that were dedicated to the political process, to forming political parties and to running in elections, and to basically endorsing the existing order while trying to change it from the inside, those have met with failure pretty much everywhere. There are a few glimmers, like places like Tunisia, where they're still trying that route, places like Morocco. But for most other places, the political path, the path of normal politics, hasn't given the Islamists what they wanted, and so more radical forces are coming forward.
What role did political exclusion play in making violence the only resort in a country like Egypt, for example?
I think that Islamists have to take some of the responsibility. The Muslim Brotherhood, when they were in power, were inexperienced and they did not know how to reach out to the opposition, and they did not form all that inclusive a strategy. They claim that they tried and failed, but they simply were not good at this. I think that since July 3rd, since the overthrow of Morsi, the new regime hesitated slightly, but then came down very, very hard on the Islamists, and I think Egyptians will be paying a high price for that decision to exclude them for another generation.
What's needed to prevent the potential creation of another ISIS in the region?
I think little ISISs are going to pop up all over as long as the political process is closed. I think that in the aftermath of the Arab uprisings of 2011, there was a possibility for some countries to develop healthy political processes so that the message to people who were unhappy with existing arrangements was join politics, form political parties, run for elections. I think that's what the Arab world has to go back to, but I think it will be some time before it actually does.
Final question. If Islamist violence is stemming from political and socioeconomic problems in the Middle East, how would you explain the appeal of violent extremism among thousands of foreign fighters from around the world, including Europe and the U.S.?
It's very, very hard to say. When you're talking about individuals, you're talking about individual psychology. I don't know what's attracting them. What I find actually just disturbing is the number of people who are not going to join ISIS. They're not going to travel to Iraq or Syria, or they're not going to travel to Sinai. But they still look at ISIS or groups like that and think at least they're doing something. They look upon them with a little bit of sympathy. They're not going to join them, but the groups like ISIS are increasingly setting the political agenda in a very unhealthy way.
Political science professor Nathan Brown of Georgetown University. Italian officials say the number of migrants making the treacherous Mediterranean crossing to Europe has soared. Most of these people from Africa and the Middle East are seeking to escape war, poverty, and terrorism. Today, we continue our conversation with Judith Sunderland of Human Rights Watch in Milan, Italy. We ask what the migrants who survived the treacherous crossing find once they reach Europe.
What they find is sort of a hodgepodge of measures and accommodation and welcome, essentially. The European Union technically has a common asylum system with common standards and procedures, but in reality, there are very different systems in place in different EU countries. So, the kind of accommodation, the kind of procedure, the kind of integration measures that asylum seekers will have depends greatly on the country in which they are able to apply for asylum. Greece is held up as the, worst example of a country with an absolutely still dysfunctional asylum system, despite some efforts to improve the situation. Whereas, countries in the north in Northern Europe tend to have better systems, better accommodation, better integration measures. And in fact, most people reaching the EU wishing to apply for asylum are trying to get to countries like Germany and Sweden, where, although I should note the surge in the number of asylum seekers over the past few years has put considerable strain on the asylum system, particularly in Germany. And there are a lot of cracks in the system that are becoming more and more apparent.
Not only are the governments getting overloaded with the number of immigrants, but residents of these European countries are becoming irritated by this flow.
Yes, well, indeed. I think what's important to say is that you have in Europe, in a number of countries, populist, right-wing, anti-immigrant political parties that, really prey on people's fears and fan xenophobic sentiment. And then you have scenes like we have had here in Italy of residents protesting violently against centers accommodating asylum seekers. You have, really quite brutal xenophobic violence in the streets of Athens. In Greece, you have the Pegida movement, sort of right-wing political party movement, particularly in eastern Germany, that focuses a lot on getting rid of the foreigners with a lot of anti-asylum seeker rhetoric. And all of this, of course, weighs on even more mainstream political parties, ruling political parties, and you have a bit of a shift to the right in terms of political discourse and a very clear reluctance on the part of many EU governments to actually do the right thing, which is go out there into the Mediterranean with robust search and rescue operations, bring people safely to shore, and then provide them with decent accommodation as their asylum claims are being processed. And indeed, if they are not asylum seekers and they have no claim to remain in the EU, then take the steps necessary to deport them back to their countries of origin if that can be done safely and in a humane way.
And really, this all starts in the home countries. Is the Human Rights Watch calling for anything to be done at the roots where this all begins?
Well, of course. I mean, that's what we do. We look at we work to try to improve human rights situation in countries around the world. And quite clearly, since so many of the people trying to reach Europe are fleeing persecution and war and serious human rights abuses, a fundamental part of the answer has to be addressing those root causes and improving the lives of people in their own countries. Most people actually do not want to leave their home countries, right? They do so because they feel compelled to, either because of persecution or war, because of deep poverty, right? But these are very long-term struggle, right? To improve the human rights situation in a given country, and while that has to be a central plank in the EU's response, just as development aid should be, that's not going to save lives today, right? So what the EU also has to do is make a genuine commitment to saving lives in the Mediterranean.
Judith Sunderland, Acting Deputy Director for the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch in Milan, Italy.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter is in South Korea, kicking off his first Asian tour. VOA's Carla Babb is traveling with him.
The Secretary of Defense wants to show the support for a strong ally. Both of the countries that Secretary Carter has visited these past few days have been very strong allies. He's in South Korea now. Prior to this, he was in Japan. And he wants to help broaden the ties between these nations. And he wants to continue reminding them that, hey, the United States wants to rebalance to Asia. Asia is the place that's growing. Asia is peaceful now, so it's not always in the news, but we still have you on our minds, and we still want to continue working with you.
How is his visit being received there?
It's been well received so far in Japan and in Korea. As I mentioned before, these are two strong allies of the United States. But I will say that it has been receiving some feedback in China as well. Sometimes the Chinese and the Japanese have had their own disputes over islands in the East China Sea. China's also had some disputes in the South China Sea. And Secretary Carter made comments in Japan saying that while the United States is not taking a side on these disputes, the United States does support not militarizing any sort of action. So they want diplomacy and peaceful resolutions to these situations. And also Secretary Carter has said that the United States is going to be defending Japan. Japan is an ally. He was there basically talking about strengthening U.S.-Japan defense guidelines. Japan is altering its guidelines on defense for the third time. And as they finalize these, they should be finalized by the end of this month when Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visits President Barack Obama in Washington. And as they're finalizing these, they want to keep coordinating and have close coordination, whether it be peacetime or in conflicts.
This is the Secretary's first Asian tour. Where else will he be going?
After Seoul, he's going to be in meetings with senior officials on the peninsula today, and then he's going to head to Hawaii. Hawaii is the base for the U.S. Pacific Command, and he's going to be talking with senior leaders there on how the Pacific Command is working, preparations, finding their needs as we talk budget more and more coming up, and basically seeing what's going on, how their relationships are working with the Asia Pacific.
VOA's Carla Babb reporting from Seoul, South Korea. A jury in the northeastern U.S. city of Boston will now decide whether to sentence Dzhokhar Dzhonaev to death or life in prison after finding him guilty in the 2013 terrorist attack on the Boston Marathon. The 21-year-old was convicted on all 30 of the charges brought against him, including murder and use of a weapon of mass destruction. Zlatica Hoke looks at what's next in the process.
The guilty verdict announced Wednesday was the only one possible in Tsarnaev's case because the defense never contested the charges, says a law expert in Washington.
This was all about setting things up for the second stage, the determination of whether or not he should be given the death penalty.
The state of Massachusetts does not have the death penalty, but in a federal case like this one, execution is possible and even likely.
If there ever was a case in which a group of people would decide that this case is worthy of the death penalty, this would be it. I mean, this was a deliberate assault, an effort to kill as many people as possible, maim as many people as possible, who are totally innocent of anything. And then, when the hunt was on for the bombers, then the notion was they would go to New York and do it again.
If given the death penalty, Tsarnaev can appeal to higher courts, going as high as the U.S. Supreme Court. But Salzburg says there is little hope that any appeal would succeed.
It doesn't seem as though there are any of the usual factors that we see, that he doesn't seem to be making a claim that he's mentally incompetent and can't be executed, or that he was a minor and can't be executed. And so it will be very difficult to overturn a sentence of death if that sentence is in fact imposed.
Tsarnaev's lead defense lawyer, Judy Clark, is one of the country's best criminal attorneys. She has successfully saved from the death penalty several people convicted of horrific crimes, including Unabomber Ted Kaczynski and Olympic Park bomber Eric Rudolph. Clark is expected to plead for Tsarnaev's life because of his young age and the influence of his older brother and co-conspirator. If she is successful, her client will be sentenced to life without parole, which means only a presidential pardon could commute his sentence.
Given the nature of the crimes, he would be highly likely placed in a supermax prison, one of those prisons where you're locked up 23 hours a day by yourself and essentially out by yourself for an hour a day.
Some Americans consider this kind of solitary imprisonment to be cruel and unusual punishment, even for the worst offenders. Many inmates lose their sanity in such prisons. Victims of the Tsarnaev brothers' bombings want justice, even if some are not sure what that would be.
I don't know what justice is. I'm grateful to have him off the street. I'm grateful to show everyone, the world, that it's not tolerated. This is not how we behave.
The sentencing deliberations may take several months or more. The defense may decide to bring Tsarnaev to the stand, and if he can be presented as sufficiently remorseful, it may move the jurors to spare his life. But all 12 of them must agree on that. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
The witness who recorded the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer in the southeastern U.S. city of North Charleston, South Carolina, last week, says he initially considered erasing the video from his cell phone. Fiden Santana told NBC News Wednesday that Officer Michael Slager had control of the situation after subduing Walter Scott with his electronic stun gun or taser, moments after pulling Scott over for a traffic violation. Santana began recording the incident at the point when the 50-year-old Scott began running away from Slager. Slager pulled his gun and fired 8 shots at Scott, who collapsed about 9 meters away. Santana said he felt that my life with this information might be in danger. He said he turned the video over to Scott's family after reading the police version of the events in the news. Slager initially said he opened fire after Scott had taken his electronic stun gun during a scuffle. A lawyer for the family gave the video to the New York Times, which posted it on its website Tuesday. Slager was arrested and charged with murder in last Saturday's shooting of Walter Scott and also has been fired from his post. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 23 years since the United States recognized the independent sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Indeed, we were among the first governments to do so. Since then, the lens through which we view Central Asia may have changed, but our commitment to enduring partnerships that advance our interests and values in the region has not, said Deputy Secretary of State Anthony Blinken.
And the reason for this is simple. Our security is tied to a stable Central Asia, and at the same time, we see a region of enormous potential. A region that could act as an economic bridge from Istanbul to Shanghai and provide opportunities for our own businesses, technologies, and innovations to take root. A region that could offer goods and energy to the booming economies of South and East Asia, and a region that could serve as a stabilizing force for Afghanistan's transition, and an indispensable partner in the fight against narco-trafficking, terrorism, and extremism.
And so, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, our overarching objectives in our engagement with each of the Central Asian states are strengthening partnerships to advance mutual security, forging closer economic ties, and advancing and advocating for improved governance and human rights. So we are expanding our law enforcement cooperation with Kazakhstan, strengthening Tajikistan's border security, and partnering with Uzbekistan to combat narco-trafficking. We are working on shared security challenges with Kyrgyzstan and in Turkmenistan. We are providing state-of-the-art technology to combat smuggling and to fight human trafficking. At the same time, we are helping Central Asia to unlock its great economic potential through the New Silk Road Initiative, which will improve regional connectivity and improve regional trade. Ultimately, for Central Asia to fully reap the benefits of shared prosperity, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, it has some choices to make between the political and economic practices of the past that offered limited potential for long-term, diversified growth, and the possibilities of the future, the surge of innovation and energy that comes from building more open societies at home and joining a dynamic, just, and rules-based global marketplace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.